Using our contemporary tools of social media, you can stalk people all over the world using things like Facebook and Instagram. You also can stock plates of food you're never going to eat. And through my friends Robert and Carolyn Collins, I discovered Superiority Burger. And I thought, I'm never going to get to eat this food. Until on August 15th of 2018, Superiority Burger did a pop-up restaurant in Portland, Oregon. Which is how Aaron Yankee and myself, Kate McCourt, came to interview Brooks Headley in the KBOO studios on August 16th of 2018.
My name is Brooks Headley. I run a restaurant in New York City called Superiority Burger, and now I'm here.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So how did you do it? How'd you make it happen?
It's kind of a weird, funny, stressful thing to like take what we do in this tiny little space in New York City and like transplant it, because as much as equipment-wise and space-wise, we don't really have a lot of either, but we know exactly what to do in order to make a ton of food. And then to take that idea and someone's like, oh, why don't you do a lunch thing at this place in Portland? And of course, we always say, yeah, of course, let's do it. And then in the process of it, you realize that trying to make a huge amount of food and transport some in suitcases and coolers on airplanes and stuff, it starts to get a little ludicrous after a while. You're not totally sure if it's going to work, and then it usually works, but it's definitely like super stressful up until the point that you're all done.
Totally. But you're not alone, right?
I brought Dave. He's sitting across without his mic on. It's never like so organized that you have everything set up for hours and you're just waiting, you know. It's more like, okay, everything's set up. Oh, no, there's a people. Oh, there's the food. And then all of a sudden it's all done. The adrenaline rush of that is kind of cool too. If we didn't like that, we wouldn't do it.
How much did you bring with you, and where did you get what you got in Portland?
We got a bunch of stuff from Groundworks Organics, peaches and okra and green beans, really good stuff. We had Yuba shipped from Oakland, this place called Hodo Soy. That's one of our favorite places. We use a ton of their tofu and their Yuba being soy milk skin. So we made a sandwich with that. Hodo Soy has been pretty awesome. They always donate stuff to us when we do these events. We said very nice things about them in the cookbook. So so they have been very generous in letting us get their stuff for these events. So that's cool. And then we brought some ice cream, regular ice cream and vegan ice cream too, which is interesting to take on an airplane because it's frozen. You have to pack it in dry ice, pack it again in a little bit of dry ice so it meets the TSA requirements, and then just hope and pray that it makes it 15 or 16 hours outside of a freezer, which I think we've got a pretty good system for it. So it made it, so we were able to serve it. Because that's another thing, like we have, it's the only piece of equipment we have at the restaurant that's like an expensive specialty thing, which is the gelato machine. We know how it works and what we can do in it. So for us to try to come to another part of the country and another restaurant, which might not have the machine that we want, it would make that a lot more stressful. It's easier to just make it and bring it. Ice cream machines are one of the more ridiculous pieces of equipment to buy when you're building a restaurant, you know, because they're insanely expensive, way more expensive than you think they should be for what they do. Our ice cream machine costs more than all of the remodeling we did, all of the tiling and building furniture, and all of the other kitchen equipment combined. The ice cream machine costs more than that. But I can assure you that it makes very, very good ice cream, and that it's our baby, and that we, you know, we treat it like gold. So
it was amazing.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know it was cross-country amazing.
Cool.
Like, this is amazing.
The whole point of any sort of frozen sorbet, gelato, ice cream, anything like that, is to spin it as fast as possible so the ice crystals are small, so it's ultra creamy. It's all about texture, you know, mm-hmm. which is almost as important as the flavor in something like that. From 18 years of working as a pastry chef, I learned that when I opened up Superiority Burger, I was like, I need to get this machine. because I insisted on it when we were opening, it kind of got filtered its way into the opening costs. But if I wanted to buy it now, forget it. So I knew that would happen, so I got it early.
Clearly you came with like, we have to make this, we have to make this, we have to make this. And then how much were you like, let's see what we find in Portland and we can kind of wing it?
We might have tried to plan this one all out completely, which of course doesn't always work. The plan was to make a potato salad. It's easy to make a big batch of it and then just kind of scoop it as you go. That ended up not working.
What didn't work about it and what did you turn
something,
it into?
I don't know. Dave and I were just talking about it this morning when we were walking around. We're at a record store talking about cooking. Cooking is, you know, it's kind of hard. It tends to maybe get a reputation as being, oh, and, you know, everyone does it. So in the case of the potato salad at issue here, it was the potatoes came out kind of weird after we boiled them. They're weirdly kind of dry. Mm-hmm. We couldn't figure out why. So we ended up turning them into like a crunchy fried thing. Because they had a deep fryer. We don't have a deep fryer at the restaurant. So for us, it was kind of this novelty thing. It was like, oh, there's a deep fryer. Oh, this is going to be good. So we were able to turn it into a thing. And then we were going to give away this bean soup kind of pasta fagioli thing to everyone that came in. We changed that around a little bit. We strained off all the beans from that and then pureed those and made kind of like a bean puree for the crunchy potatoes to go on top of. Totally unplanned, and this was kind of like figured out along the way right before we're actually going to serve the stuff, and it ended up being like probably better than the thing we were going to do initially, which was definitely pretty fun.
The Yuba Verde sandwich was awesome. I want to know everything about it.
Oh yeah, that's one of our because the space in New York is so small, it's a pretty small menu. It's like 7 things on the menu, and then we have a little specials board depending on what we found at the market or what we just were feeling, or you know, sometimes somebody will come in having just eaten at a restaurant the night before, or maybe it was just up at 3 a.m. googling like Pennsylvania Dutch recipes or something, because that's what we do when we work in a restaurant all the day, and then we'll figure out something we can run to go along with it. And then the Yuba Verde sandwich ended up turning into this thing that we almost never list on the specials board and never list on the menu. It's funny too, because a lot of times people will come to the restaurant and they'll see somebody eating something. They'll go, what's that? And they'll go, oh, it's the Yuba Verde sandwich. And then they'll get mad and be like, well, what's not listed anywhere? And I was like, well, we, you know, there's pictures of it on the internet. You know? And I was like, that's not secret at all. You know? But the Yuba Verde sandwich, it's kind of a combination of like a bunch of different things. When Dave first started working, he came up with this marinade that we initially used for tofu that was kind of like a marinade that you would put on like on ham. We made the marinade and it was kind of sweet, and we put tofu in it and we called it city tofu, because it wasn't like a country ham, it was like a city ham. But then again, it's not ham at all, it's tofu. And it's not, the intention has never been with anything we do at the restaurant that it is like a complete mimic of meat, even though the whole place is vegetarian and mostly vegan. It's more like, what can we do that's really delicious, that is like texturally exciting, that can go on a sandwich and be something that's really good to eat? So we called it city tofu. That was like almost like a bologna vibe.
Totally, yeah.
Which is funny because I hate bologna. I've always hated bologna.
Me but, too.
So then we ended up using it, the same marinade, to do the Yuba. Because the Yuba that we get from Hodo Soy is like, it's just the coolest stuff in the world. It's really thin, but also really chewy. And as opposed to something like tofu, it doesn't necessarily like have to sit in a marinade for a long time to soak up the flavor. It really just kind of sits on the outside layers because it's so thin. So you can make something and throw it in it. It's ready to use almost immediately. A lot of the events we've done this summer, we do the Yuba sandwich. Number one, because we can get the Yuba for free. But also because it's like, I think it's one of the more interesting things that we serve at the restaurant too, because it's so meat-like, while at the same time not being in any way one of these like highly processed fake meat things, which I don't necessarily have a problem with. I think they're silly. When they say they bleed, they never actually bleed. Which is one thing. It's like, if you're going to say that, then it better bleed, you know?
I've seen bleeding.
Yeah, right? And it's also got a ton of vegetables on it, too. we blanch broccoli rabe and then saute some pickled shallots. And then one of my more favorite parts, we make a call it sausaged cecchi, which is basically chickpeas that we roast in the oven with tons of all of the flavors that would go into like an Italian sausage, except it's chickpeas and it's obviously vegan. And then we roast them until they're almost dried out and then grind them up again, maybe even adding a little bit more liquid to them if they get too dry. And then the idea is they become this paste. Even though like we're flirting with like a hummus thing, it's not, and not in any way hummus. It's not a super smooth chickpea garlic thing. It's like this rough chopped sausage tasting chickpea spread. A lot of the food that we do at the restaurant is inspired by actual non-vegetarian things that either I don't like or can't stand, like bologna, or things that maybe I'd witnessed at other restaurants where I worked, but never actually ate. Because when I worked in other restaurants, I was a pastry chef, so I was only doing desserts. A lot of things I would see the other cooks working with, I would never actually eat, but I would look at it and be like, huh, that's interesting. I'm going to file that one away. So like the chickpea sausage spread is kind of like based on this Southern Italian sausage that is more spreadable. Like it's not something that you actually eat. It all kind of works together. So it's the end result is this completely 100% vegan sandwich that's really satisfying, has lots of vegetables in it, has a really good, like intense flavor, but is inspired by a bunch of meat that I never ate.
Food. Clearly, it's been something you've been doing your whole life because you're still alive. But, you know, when did it become like a thing that you actually paid attention to?
I mean, I always loved to cook and I loved just food in general. I started doing it professionally pretty late. I was 27 at the time. The band I was in had just broken up and I needed a job and I had an English degree that was worthless, so ended up in a restaurant, and it was the thing where, like, the second I walked into, like, professional restaurant kitchen, it was like I knew that that's what I wanted to do the rest of my life. I've heard people say stuff like that before. I'm like, oh, that's a crock, you know? But this is that actually was what I felt. Before that, like, I mean, I cooked a little bit with my family, but never anything too complex or anything. In fact, I have a very specific memory of as a kid, because my mom was Italian, so she made homemade pasta sauces and homemade pastas and stuff like that. But I remember specifically the first time I went over to a friend's house and had spaghetti with like ragu or prego jarred pasta sauce, you know, which I immediately fell in love with. If you look on the back of the label, the first ingredient is corn syrup, you know, so it's like candy as spaghetti. Yeah. You know? So I remember being at the grocery store with my mom the next time and like pointing to the jars of bottled spaghetti sauce and being like, that's the stuff right there. Yeah. And she was just like, I make this stuff, you know, like you don't need to buy it. And I was like, well, like sort of felt sorry for her. I was like, no, that's the real stuff right there. So.
And how old were you in this?
8 or 9, maybe something like that. And then I did a lot of cooking, family stuff, like cookies during the holidays and stuff like that, but never really thought about doing it professionally. And then when I played music in the early 90s, everyone that I was in a band with, we were all vegetarian. You were either vegan or vegetarian, just, and everyone you knew was vegan and vegetarian. Like, there wasn't anyone that you ran into, at least in our particular little scene, that wasn't. The same way that was exciting to, like, go on tour and find a record store in, like, New Orleans where you could get a bunch of records you wouldn't be able to get otherwise, you know? The search for food became part of the fun of going on tour. You had to figure out what to do if you were in Columbia, South Carolina, or Minot, North Dakota, or whatever, you know. So that became this, like, the constant exciting struggle of where you were going to get the vegetarian food, you know. We were all just totally obsessed with food. But in this very pointed little subculture of punk rock, hardcore kid vegetarianism, you know. So there would be, like, Berkeley, California, or San Francisco, it's just like the promised land.
Yeah.
Whatever you wanted, there'd just be a normal store and just be like, oh my God, everything. Meanwhile, like the next show might be in Bakersfield. They're going to go get some potatoes and bake them at the guy's parents' house you're staying at. I grew up in Baltimore, so going to like Positive Force shows in DC in like the late 80s, early 90s, the bands you're watching are your idols, and they have this information in the back of the show. It's like, you couldn't eat meat. This is the way it's going to be then, you know, so, which is funny too, because like whenever I do read or see any like information packets that come out with these like new like fake meat things in 2017, 2018, it's the same exact information as was at the back pamphlet table at the Positive Force show. So it's always like, oh, you guys finally figured it out, right?
Yeah.
You
know, so.
The state never listens to us. The state does nothing. You could sign petitions till you're 100 years old, and they're just thrown in the bin. So what do you do when nobody listens to you? And at the end of the day, animals are going through hell. What do you do?
Whenever anyone asks me about this, I always bring it up, but there was a place in San Diego, it was called Fake Burger, F-A-Q-U-E. There was something so special about it because, I mean, if you grow up, I grew up in Baltimore, so the idea of a place like San Diego even existing is already, like, weird. It's on the beach and people live there. It's like, that's weird. Like how do, I didn't even understand how that worked, you know? And then there's this, like, vegetarian vegan restaurant that is like a looks like a Dairy Queen, and you go there and you get French fries and veggie burgers, and your mind would just like explode. But it's become so mythical in my head that I actually don't even remember if it was any good. To this day, I'm 45 years old, like I still talk about it like it was one of the greatest restaurant experiences of my life.
So then how did you get from being like a punk or food person, they just kind of formed you into a dessert person?
Well, because I was pretty strict vegetarian at the time, like, I wouldn't wanted to have worked the line. I would have had to, like, break down meat and process meat and cook meat, which I had no interest in it. And I also probably thought it would have been kind of gross to deal with. I'm going back to the pamphlets at the Positive Force table. You know,
so. Totally.
When it came time to eat family meal, and I'm, like, new working at a restaurant, I didn't even understand the concept of family meal, which
what is family meal?
When all the restaurant eats. All of the...
Before
shift. Yeah. Okay. It's usually, like, a restaurant that is open for dinner, you'll have family meal at, like, 4 or 4:30. Okay. Depending on the restaurant, it can be really amazing or really kind of gross, like everything that's about to go bad or made with no love at all. We make really good family meal at Superiority Burger, like after service, and that's totally made with love. We also don't necessarily do it every single night. So a lot of things that I had never eaten before or had no idea I was eating, I ate for the first time at family meal at the first restaurant where I worked. You know, it's free food. You're not getting paid anything, and you're hungry. You're surrounded by food, so you're going to eat it. It was interesting, the actual job part where I was just making desserts, because we were making stuff that didn't exist beforehand, which was the thing that really jazzed me and got me into it. If you're a grill cook and you have a raw burger and then you have a cooked burger, depending on the place, there's some skill that goes into getting it from point A to point B so it's edible and delicious and whatever. The thing that really excited me with doing desserts is like we're taking flour and butter and sugar and eggs and like twisting them around and turning them into this thing that 45 minutes ago didn't exist. Any sort of cake or something where air was a main desired result. Those were the things that really excited me, which even to this day is like a really exciting thing, is making stuff that's really light. You can eat more of it. Or just the idea that you've captured empty space. For a lot of like bread things, like that's like one of the main things you're trying to do, is have this beautiful, delicious structure that's completely filled with air.
Huh.
That's like the most magical thing. Plus, when I initially started doing it, and it was desserts, and I also really, really, really loved making ice cream. Even though I can't necessarily say, prior to working in a professional kitchen, I was really this like ice cream fanatic. I mean, I liked it ice cream as much as everyone likes ice cream, you know, because ice cream is amazing. Learning how to make it, and especially like fruit sorbets, to this day is like one of my favorite things to do. The idea is taking a bunch of fruit, maybe that's really, really good, or maybe not so good, depending on the time of the year or what's available or whatever. Taking that fruit, pureeing it, watering it down, adding sugar to it, and then putting it in a machine, and then have the end result taste like the ultimate version of the first thing that you started with. The first time I did that and was able to do that, I was like, wow, this is cool. That was definitely one of the more exciting things that I remember from like my first times cooking. Kind of in the same way when you're in a band and you're like four knuckleheads in like a practice space and you come up with a song and then you like fine tune that song and that becomes the thing that you play when you go on tour. Like, it didn't exist before. You might have stole a little bit from this other band here, a little bit from this other thing here, but the end result is like that's your thing.
Like, why do fancy chefs, why do they always wear those white outfits? White seems like the worst color. Like, why would you do that?
Because part of it, yeah, exactly. You wear the white chef's coat and then a white apron over top of it. If any food splatters on it, then you're seen as being kind of a hack because you're not clean enough, you know?
Oh, it's which like is a test.
It's sort of a test. Yeah. It's kind of funny because I actually really like it when we have this woman, Darcy, that works at the restaurant. And one of the other things about restaurants is like linen services, side towels and aprons. And you just have to order them and they have to be cleaned and they have to come. And sometimes it doesn't come in time and there's no aprons or there's no towels. You know, it's like a big mess and then you're waiting for it or whatever. But if it's a day Darcy's making raspberry sorbet or a bunch of different sauces or whatever and there's no aprons, like her shirt will just be completely splattered with food, because that's what happens, you know, like I've got splatters all over this thing because I was working, but I actually really like that you're working, you know, like it's gonna be messy, you know.
So you're the author of two cookbooks now. There's a lot of backstory in the first one.
Yeah,
there's not as much backstory in the Superiority Burger cookbook.
Almost none. Intentionally so.
So just to cover the bases, when did you start thinking you were going to do your own restaurant? How'd you make it happen?
It wasn't like I had this intense desire for years to have my own restaurant. New York's really expensive, and the idea of opening up a restaurant in New York is so daunting. I'd been working as a pastry chef for a long time, and I was kind of fine with that, really. It was still fun. But then started like messing around with this veggie burger recipe that ended up being the main thing we sell at the restaurant. Honestly, it went really fast. It was in the space of a couple months where there was no plan. And then all of a sudden, I quit my job. And we had a space that we were kind of trying to turn into a restaurant. There wasn't a lot of planning involved with it, which we all still feel today because we have this 6-seat 275 square foot restaurant that is amazing in the summer, but in the winter there's only 6 seats, so that creates a problem, you know. Mm-hmm. It's 10 degrees outside. So
when you say we, like, how many people is that?
I have a few partners, and it was the kind of thing where we all just cobbled together some money to like get the space, buy the ice cream machine, all that kind of thing. You know, a lot of times people open restaurants and all of a sudden there's millions of dollars being floated around, and like, this is definitely not that situation, you know. This was as low key as you can probably get and still actually physically open up a business, you know.
Did they want to open up a restaurant, or you're just like hanging out together and be like, we could do this thing, your food's awesome, like, let's do it, like kind of that?
Yes,
that...
you just, yeah, exactly, you just did it.
Like, I mean,
honestly that's kind of it, because any if we had actually thought about it a little harder, mm-hmm. like maybe it wouldn't exist. That's real, you really nailed it. So
I probably got the voices wrong, but...
Yeah, you're pretty close.
Do you feel like you're running a punk restaurant?
We have this weird little restaurant where it's all vegetarian and we sell things for the least amount of money possible. I mean, in the end, it's a business, of course, but I kind of struggle with that. There are times when I'm like, it feels like this revolutionary little restaurant or whatever. But then there are other times where it's like, oh, I just have a vegetarian restaurant. It's weird. All the music stuff and everything that I did leading up to this, like, you know, it's still a part of my psyche or whatever. To say that that didn't or doesn't influence what we do at the restaurant It does, for sure. I mean, I really like it when people that I know from the punk rock world come to the restaurant and are all excited to eat there. I'll pretty much give away food at the drop of a hat. So if any sort of anyone that even looks like a band shows up, first we try to figure out what band it is if we don't recognize them. And we can always tell because it's always four or five people and they always pay separately. So you immediately know it's a band. Happens a lot on Sunday mornings. Like we open at 11:30 and at 11:33 there's like five people walk in. There was this crusty band from Denmark or something in full regalia. And I was so excited that they had decided to come to the restaurant or whatever. So I started giving them a bunch of free stuff. It's a small place. They took up the whole restaurant. And I started giving them like free shots of soup and stuff. I think they were like a little confused as to why is this person doing this? Or like, I don't know. There have been a couple of times where I specifically remember there was that band Deathside from Japan played in New York. And it was like this big thing where people from all over the country came to hang out. So we were like mobbed for 3 days with just like punk kids. And I was so excited. One of the last days, like it was a couple and they came down. They were sitting in the window seat. The guy was wearing a Nervous Gender shirt. And I was like, this is so cool. This kid is wearing a homemade Nervous Gender shirt and he's eating at my restaurant. So I started giving them a bunch of free stuff. And then I like went back to work. And then I looked over and they were gone. They like slipped out. And I don't know if that was because they're shy, which is fine. I was super shy when I was a kid. And in that kind of situation, I probably would have slunk out too. But then also I was like, well, maybe they thought I was going to charge them for it or something too. Which is also, either way, it's like, you know, it's still cool. So.
Or you're just grandma them.
Eat right, more. Exactly. Yeah, you're so skinny, you know. Yeah.
That's national, international community coming to you. But you also, you have this really special relationship the way you talk about your regulars. So restaurants as a ground for community and how it works and doesn't work.
Sure.
In general, I think, and also for you personally.
I really like that aspect of the restaurant. That's something that's pretty different about Superiority Burger as opposed to other places. We do have a ton of regulars. We have people that come almost every day. It's sort of nuts, but it's kind of a good gauge. Like, when there is someone that comes almost every day, if we have at least one thing that's sort of new or something that we haven't had in a while, then I know we're kind of like still pushing. We've still got some creativity left in us. But no, it's cool. And I always kind of describe it to people where 95% of the people that come to the restaurant are kind of awesome. Someone I'd want to hang out with or someone that I'm excited to see when they come in. And from all different like walks of life, we're not just talking like punk kids with Nervous Gender shirts, you know. That's kind of cool because in a normal restaurant where the whole business plan is based on commerce and making as much money as possible, maybe only 5% of the people are cool when you'd want to hang out with. Maybe the rest of them are kind of terrible people that just happen to like the food that you have, you know. And I've watched other people that I know open up businesses, restaurants and or bars in New York City specifically. And then they open up their business or whatever, and then all of a sudden the clientele becomes what I call the terrible people of the East Village. The East Village of Manhattan, of all neighborhoods to be infiltrated by, like, jocks and bros and the worst kind of people ever, you know, like, they want to, like, turn the East Village into, like, the suburbs. Ugh, it's gross. And they, like, travel in packs. I will tell you that drunk bros on a Friday or Saturday night, the thing that is the most irresistible to them is an orange safety cone. An orange safety cone sitting outside the restaurant becomes something that's like, something about like shorts and flip-flops and like a Oxford unbuttoned shirt. If you see an orange safety cone, you fall madly in love with that orange safety cone for about 250 feet before you become bored with it. But you can wear it as a hat. You can try to joust your friend with it. And then eventually you put it on top of a car. And then I walk outside and I go grab it because I'm not about to get beaten up by 8 drunk bros.
Yeah. Who are in the middle of the most intense love affair.
A safety cone is 20 bucks. I can always get a new one. So. We specifically close early. We also don't sell any alcohol. So we repel those people in the neighborhood. The place is bright, there's no meat, and there's no alcohol, so there's really nothing for them. It's not what they want. The fact that it's such a small, little, weird restaurant that we have such an amazing clientele. It's cool to call our regulars our clientele because that's what they are, you know, but it's kind of a perversion of the term clientele because clientele would normally represent the people that are flooding your restaurant or business with tons of money or whatever, you know.
How did they become like that? You know, you're like, oh, of course, but it's not an of course at all.
I'm not really sure. I love it, though. I mean, I think it's just because the whole vibe of the place is friendly, of course, but not too friendly. I've worked in a lot of fancy restaurants where they talk about the word hospitality all the time. But a lot of times it's like the ultimate hospitality. We're really going to take care of you. You come into our home and we will hospitably serve you fine wines and delicious meats and cheeses or whatever, you know. But in the end, it's just about who has the most enough money or the most money to like warrant that behavior from the staff. It's kind of this like fake hospitality. It's one of the things that always bugged me about working in fancy restaurants. It's so elitist and it's so expensive and it's not for everyone and it's only for the people that have enough money to do it. And that's one of the things that drove me out of that scene because I lived in that world for a long time. My friends couldn't come eat at these places unless they came in and then I gave them everything for free, which really endeared me to all of my former bosses, you know. So, but I figured like there's enough money coming in, I can at least do that. I mean, it does feel really focused on like our neighborhood, you know, and not even necessarily our neighborhood. We have people that live in other parts of the country that when they come to New York, they always come to visit us. I'm psyched to see them. They're psyched to be there. And like, if we can get a bunch of awesome produce, make a bunch of cool salads, and somebody can come in and spend, you know, you can come into the restaurant and spend $10 and you get a burger and a broccoli salad. $10.89 with New York State sales tax. That's not really that much money for, it's a totally composed salad of like multiple components and the sandwich that we've worked on forever. Like, especially in Manhattan in 2018, spending under $11. We have a tank full of tap water that we constantly spike with lemon juice and has tons of ice. And that makes me happy that we have a place where we can sell food for that cheap and still 3 years in still, and we're still in business. And it's not even just in New York, but where are you going to get something like that for $10? I like how the restaurant's progressed from the beginning, for sure. I just can't imagine working in a fancy, expensive restaurant right now. Like, Donald Trump is the president and all these terrible things are happening. Like, it'd just be the most useless thing that you could do. Whereas going to the market and buying the same exact produce as the fancy restaurants, but serving it in disposable paper containers in like a small little weird restaurant in the East Village, I don't have any desire to like do anything other than that. I have a lot of friends and or colleagues or whatever from the restaurant world that their goal is to have like the fancy restaurant and then the casual restaurant and then like the fast food restaurant. I don't want to have any of those things. I just want to have the place where we figure out a way to like subvert the whole thing or whatever. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe it is. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you still play music? Are you still going to shows?
I haven't played a show since the restaurant has been open. It's been about 3 years, which is the longest stretch that I've ever gone ever in my life. Even when I was working in fancy restaurants, if I went about a year and a half without forming a band or playing a show, like something would happen and I would start doing stuff again. But that was also like I was hired to work for someone else. Superiority Burger is my thing, so there's always something to do. Although I will say I do have a pile of drumsticks on my station above near my cookbooks. If I ever just had to leave on the spot and go.
And go jump and, on some
and
drums.
Go, and go leave everything, then I would be able to do that. So.
When the Spinal Trap drummer dies, you get to like, get called in, you're ready.
All that stuff's still really important to me.
This interview was recorded, edited, produced, and mixed by Kate McCourt and Aaron Yankee. Mostly Aaron Yankee.
I think that's perfect.
Okay, good.
All right.
Let's chop it up.
I don't want to eat another Sunday roast with the family.